me when I first heard about Jesus is how he doesn't give us a bunch of directions intended to manipulate our behavior or control our conduct. Instead, he has beautiful hopes for us and has told us what those are. But he isn't scowling at us when we aren't ready to have those same hopes for ourselves. He won't love us more or less based on how we act. And he's more interested in our hearts than all the things we do. He's not stuck telling us what to do, when to do it, and what we want either. Far better, he continues to tell us through our successes and our mistakes who we are. And here's what he wants us to know. We are his. Chapter 5. Limo Driver. Don't build a castle when you can build a kingdom. I received a call from someone organizing a national conference for Christian radio broadcasters. He said they meet once a year and their next meeting would be at Disney World in Orlando. They wanted me to speak at the event and he asked me to pray about whether I should come. You pray about it, I told him. It's Disney World. I'm coming. I don't know if thinking about something is the same as praying about something. Probably not. I think people often get the two confused. Prayers sometimes are spontaneous cries out to God for help, and other times are well-organized attempts to lift our voices together for a specific purpose. I've never related to scripted prayers. It would be like my kids talking to me or Jesus talking to his friends using 3x5-inch note cards. When I do it right, my prayers feel like a conversation with a friend, and my words feel more like breaths of air than fancy speeches. We need every type of prayer, I suppose, but I don't think we need to sound like each other. God isn't wowed by fancy words. He delights in humble hearts. I couldn't wait to get to the radio broadcaster's event so I could see what Disney World in Florida looked like. I'm a yellow cab guy, so I got off the plane in Orlando and walked over to the taxi stand. On the way there, I saw a guy with a black hat, a suit, and a sign standing in front of a long black limo. His sign had Bob written on it. My first thought was that he was there to pick up another guy named Bob. Maybe Bob Dylan was in town. I'd always wanted to meet him. Then I noticed Goff under the name on the sign. My instinct was to walk right past the limo guy. But then I thought, what the heck? I've never been in a limo before. If they spent the cash to rent one, I'm going for a ride. I walked up to the guy with the hat and the sign and said in my loudest and most enthusiastic outdoor voice, "I'm Bob." I waved my arms like I usually do when I'm talking to people I don't know. He looked me up and down for a second, then said, "Yes, but who are you?" He wanted to know if I was famous, I suppose. I wanted to tell him, "Yes, I invented medicine," but simply said, "I'm just Bob." He looked more than a little disappointed. "I know, man. Me too," I said. I got in the back of his limo and we started driving towards the Magic Kingdom. I know God lives everywhere, but I bet he spends a lot of time at Disney World. It's a place where no one uses big words and what anybody does for a day job doesn't matter. It's a place without titles and status and where no one is stuck being who they were, unless they want to be. It's a place where our imaginations get permission to go on all the rides and our fears aren't allowed to take cuts in front of us anymore. I have the architectural plans to the castle at Disneyland. They came up for sale on eBay. I couldn't believe it. I bid my wife's car for them. She walks around town a lot now. Building a castle isn't as hard as you think if you've got enough time, space, and cash. Just get a lot of plywood, pixie dust, and a bunch of people swinging hammers and putting drawbridges in place, and you'll have one after a while. We actually build castles all the time out of our jobs and our families and the things we've purchased and sometimes even each other. Some of these castles are impressive, too. Lots of people come to admire what we've built over the course of our lives and tell us what great castles we have. But Jesus told his friends we weren't supposed to spend our lives building castles. He said he wanted us to build a kingdom. And there's a big difference between building a castle and building a kingdom. Castles have moats to keep creepy people out, but kingdoms have bridges to let everybody in. Castles have dungeons for people who've messed up, but kingdoms have grace. There's one other thing castles have. Trolls. You've met a couple. I have too. Trolls aren't bad people. They're just people I don't really understand. They're the kind of people who spend most of their time under bridges, and they make you say rhymes before you cross over. I suppose if I spent all of my time under a bridge, I wouldn't be much fun to be around either. Here's the deal. It's how we treat the trolls in our lives that will let us know how far along we are in our faith. If we want a kingdom, then we start the way Grace did, by drawing a circle around everyone and saying they're in. Kingdoms are built from the people up. There's no set of plans, just Jesus. There are plenty of people I don't understand. I suppose some are trolls and some aren't. God doesn't see people the way I do, though. The ones I see as problems, God sees as sons and daughters made in His image. The ones I see as difficult, He sees as delightfully different. The fact is, what skews my view of people who are sometimes hard to be around is that God is working on different things in their lives than He's working on in mine. I'll give you an example. There's a story in the Bible about Jesus and His friends going across a lake where they met a guy who was a troll to most of the people near him. He was mean, crazy, possessed. Jesus knew exactly what was going on in him, even when the people who lived nearby didn't. You may know what happened. All of the evil in him left and went into the pigs, and the pigs ran off a cliff. What was a great day for the guy Jesus met was an equally lousy day for the pig farmer nearby. I can almost hear the conversation the farmer must have had when his wife asked how his day at work was. Well, it was going great until a guy landed his boat on the shore and started talking to the crazy guy by the lake. Then all 2,000 of our pigs ran off a cliff and died. How come? She must have asked. The simple answer is, he probably didn't know. The real answer was that God was doing something in someone else's life, and what He was doing in the other person's life intersected with the pig farmer's life in a big way. It intersected in the pigs' lives in an even bigger way. God knows we're easily confused and oftenly wayward, and He pursues us with love anyway. I think He wants us to see things the way He does, and it's not going to happen from the top floor of our castles. It will happen at the ground level of grace. And it's going to take a lot of grace to accept that sometimes we're the person on the other side of the lake, and other times we're the pig farmer. God wants me to love the ones I don't understand, to get to know their names, to invite them to do things with me, to go and find the ones everyone has shunned and turned away, to see them as my neighbors, even if we are in totally different places. You'll be able to spot people who are becoming love because they want to build kingdoms, not castles. They fill their lives with people who don't look like them or act like them or even believe the same things as them. They treat them with love and respect and are more eager to learn from them than presume they have something to teach. There's a tradition at Disney most people don't know about. The windows in the second-story shops are dedicated to people who have helped build the kingdom there. At Disneyland in Southern California, I found a window across from the Jungle Cruise for a guy named Harper Goff. He's not related to me at all, but that's not what I tell the people who sell the tickets to get in. Like me, he played the banjo. The window says, Professor Harper Goff, banjo lessons. But banjo isn't what he'll be remembered for. You see, Harper Goff has a window at Disneyland because he helped design and build a kingdom there. Here's a question I keep asking myself. What do I want my window to say? This question is worth thinking about if you don't know the answer. What part are you going to play in building the kind of kingdom Jesus said would outlast us all? We have a lodge up in Canada. It's a tradition we've had for decades that everyone who comes to visit us climbs under the dining room table to sign it and leave a word behind. One of my friends left the word with on the bottom of the table. We've had leaders and ambassadors and ministers of foreign affairs and elementary school kids sign under the table and leave a word. We've had good guys and bad guys and undecided do the same. We've had rockers and poets and Supreme Court justices and movie makers climb under the table. We've had people whose countries were rolling tanks against each other climb under together with pins and leave their words. I don't know what God would put on His window if He had one. I don't think He'd want to have it read like a poem or look like a painting. I think He would just want it to say, with. He wouldn't need a $20 phrase or a 30-word Bible verse. He demonstrated the word with is bigger and worthier and more accessible than any 10 Bible verses. It doesn't rhyme with anything, which is a plus. It also doesn't sound like a big theological statement because it's not. It's a huge theological statement. It's God's purpose for us. It's the reason Jesus came. It's the whole Bible in a word. People who are becoming love are with those who are hurting and help them get home. I've always thought that people who didn't want to be with people here are going to hate heaven. Truly, it will be everybody always there. Helping people find their way home is the premise for many of the movies you and I have enjoyed. It's what they did with the guys on Apollo 13 when the oxygen tanks exploded mid-flight. NASA was with them as they helped them get home. Do you remember the address on the mask in Finding Nemo? P. Sherman, 42 Wallaby Way, Sydney. We all felt like we were with Nemo as he found his way home to his father. It's what Dorothy needed when she finally met the Wizard of Oz. He got in the balloon with her and helped her get home to the one she loved. We don't need to tell everyone where home is either. Jesus told his friends it would be God who would let people know who he was. Our job is simply to love people and be with them as they make their way home to a loving father, even when they blow it a couple times on the way back. I got into the back of the limo and talked to the driver through the window dividing us as we traversed Orlando on the highway. The driver was a friendly, engaging guy. After we'd driven a short time, I said, "You know, this is the first time I've ever been to Orlando, but if somebody asked me what I thought about everyone in the city, do you know what I'd tell them? I'd say I think everyone in Orlando is just terrific. Do you know why? It's simple, because you're a nice guy." I thought about how the opposite was true as well. If the limo driver had been mean or rude or pushy with me, and someone asked me what I thought of everyone in Orlando, I would have said, "I think everyone in Orlando is mean or rude or pushy." Neither statement would be true, but somehow, because of how we're wired, when we've met one person, we feel like we've met everybody. Think about it. If you know just one person in Mexico or the Philippines or Bolivia or Liechtenstein, and something happens in one of those countries, don't you feel a kinship with everyone there? It feels like we've met everyone in those countries, even though obviously we haven't. I bet this is what Jesus meant when he told his friends that people would understand who he was by watching how we treated each other. Early on, I thought big acts of generosity or great sermons or arenas full of people singing songs would help us understand God's love for us. He said it was none of these. Jesus told his friends that letting people see the way we love each other would be the best way to let people know about him. It wouldn't be because we'd given them a lot of directions or instructions, because they memorized or studied all the right things. It would be because someone met you or me and felt like they just met Jesus. I think what he meant is he wanted someone to meet a person who loved him and then feel like they just met heaven, everybody there. We drove a little further through the city, and the driver told me about his life and the people he loved. He also said he'd been driving limos for 25 years. "Wow," I said, "I bet you've met some really interesting people in that time. Not me, of course, you know, famous people." "I have," he said. "I'm really going to miss this job because I'm retiring next month." I sat back in my seat, watched the palm trees pass by for a few more minutes, and then I had a thought. I leaned forward and said through the glass, "Hey, buddy, have you ever ridden in the back of one of these limos? I bet you'd love it. They're terrific." He laughed and said, "Of course not. I'd get fired." Now I had my arm through the glass between the driver's seat and the living room-sized back seats of the limo. I think I even got a shoulder through the window. "Hey, you're quitting anyway. Pull over," I said. And you know what? He did. I got out of the back of the car and we swapped places. He got in the back and I put on his hat and jumped in behind the wheel and drove us to Disney World. He got there about 15 minutes after me. It was a pretty long limo. I carry medals with me all the time. They don't say anything on them. I'm a lawyer, so the medals mean whatever I say they mean. I opened the door and let my limo driver friend out from the back seat. He stood up and straightened his jacket, and I was still wearing his hat. I pinned a medal on his chest and said, "You're brave. You're courageous. You're foolhardy. Do you see how I took that last turn?" I spoke words of truth and affirmation to him with a smile. I patted him on the chest, gave him a hug, and walked into the hotel. When the limo driver went home that night to the woman he's been living with for the last 10 years, do you think he told her he'd met a Christian guy that date who told him he was supposed to be married? Of course not. I bet he told her he'd met a guy who told him who he was. That's our job. It's always been our job. We're supposed to just love the people in front of us. We're the ones who tell them who they are. We don't need to spend as much time as we do telling people what we think about what they're doing. We're not the school principals or the bouncers or the sheriffs. In other words, stop it. Loving people doesn't mean we need to control their conduct. There's a big difference between the two. Loving people means caring without an agenda. As soon as we have an agenda, it's not love anymore. It's acting like you care to get someone to do what you want or what you think God wants them to do. Do less of that and people will see a lot less of you and more of Jesus. Talk behind each other's backs constantly. Just talk about the right stuff. Talk about Jesus. Talk about grace. Talk about love and acceptance. People don't grow where they're informed. They grow where they're loved and accepted. Talk about who people are becoming and who you see them turning into. And give people medals, lots of them. The people around us should be walking around looking like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They should jingle when they walk. I want people to meet you and me and feel like they've just met everyone in heaven. Chapter 6, Skydiving. God was with us, so we'd be with each other. My son Adam is out of college and is fearless. He'll try anything once, but he'll do it several times if it's life-threatening. If you can't lose your arm doing it, he's usually not interested. He started taking skydiving lessons this year. These weren't the tandem jumps I was familiar with, where an experienced skydiving instructor is attached to the novice. These were solo jumps. Understandably, there's quite a bit of on-the-ground training involved in getting a skydiving license. In addition to taking some pretty involved classes before you get in the airplane, there are quite a few solo jumps you need to make with an instructor free-falling nearby to make sure you don't freak out and crater. While there's more instruction than I thought, there certainly isn't as much as is needed. When the kids were growing up, we weren't a family you would find at the local field every weekend for Little League baseball or soccer. I would have had our children join a team just so I could eat the corn dogs. But the kids never seemed interested in organized sports, so we skipped most of it. Going out to the drop zone each weekend to watch Adam skydive felt a little like what I imagined going to a Little League game would be like. Except my son, the shortstop, would be falling from 13,000 feet. An unforced air in skydiving would be more of a game changer than a ball going between his legs near second base. This was more than a little unsettling to me as I watched him strap on his parachute each weekend, get in a plane with no door in it, and fly away. Squinting as I looked towards the sun to find the airplane 2 miles overhead, I watched as Adam jumped out and started his free fall. He was smaller than an ant silhouetted against the bright blue sky. The free fall looks pretty slow from below, but the skydiver is actually falling through the air at 250 feet per second. Between the time Adam jumped out of the plane and the time the parachute opened, he had free-fallen a distance greater than 20 100-story buildings stacked end-to-end. That's a lot of down elevator. Adam explained to me with a wink that all he needs to do to get the parachute to deploy is to reach behind him while he's falling at 140 miles per hour and find a small hacky-sack ball connected to the main parachute to throw out. I always imagined if it were me doing the reaching, it wouldn't be a hacky sack I'd find. If the main parachute comes out, it gives a huge tug as it snaps full of air. If it doesn't, I suppose it would look a lot like zooming in on Google Earth really fast. Knowing how forgetful Adam can sometimes be, as he fell, I found myself shouting from below, "Pull the chute! Pull the chute! Pull the chute!" and reaching behind myself as I did. After what always seemed like way too long, I would see the parachute open and hear Adam yelping with excitement and gliding in figure eights back to the grass field near the runway. Some people listen to Christmas carols in December, but I listen to them all the time. They also read the Christmas story only once a year. I read it every couple of months. It tells us God said, "The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel." A couple verses later, it says, they gave him the name Jesus. At first, I wondered if perhaps Mary had twins. Emmanuel means God with us. As a father, I know what it feels like to want to be with your children. When God sent Jesus into the world, he demonstrated he didn't just want to be an observer in the lives of the ones he loved. He wanted to be a participant. He wanted to be with the ones he loved. I do too. After months of taking Adam to the drop zone each weekend, I decided to blow Adam's mind. So while he was at work one week, I took skydiving lessons. When I dropped off Adam the following week, he got out of the car, put on his parachute, buckled his straps, and got in the airplane. It was time for my big reveal, so I got out of the car, threw a parachute over my shoulders, buckled the slaps, and got in the plane too. Adam did a double take as I sat down next to him and adjusted my helmet. "Dad, what are you doing?" Adam asked in disbelief. "How hard could it be?" I shot back with a wink. The plane started its engines, and we rolled down the runway. When Adam and I were a few miles up in the air, the plane engine slowed a bit. The pilot turned on a green light to let us know we were over the field, and we moved to the door. There are plenty of things to do when you get ready to skydive, like pack your parachute, make a will, and say goodbye to loved ones. Once you get in the door to jump, there are only three things to remember. Up, down, and out. That's it. You practice this on the ground several times before you get in the plane. You rock up on your toes to let the people around you know you're about to go. You crouch down like you're about to jump, and then it's right out the door. You exit the plane into a 100-mile-per-hour wind and immediately disappear from view. When Adam got to the door, he yelled, "See you on the ground!" He rocked up, down, and jumped out. Not surprisingly, Adam did a backflip as he jumped out the door and disappeared from view. I'm not really sure what came over me in the moment, but there was a massive jolt of adrenaline and an overwhelming desire to be with Adam in the air as he fell. I sprang to the door, blew off all the up, down, and out stuff, and threw myself out the plane with everything I had. I jumped so hard, I jumped right out of my tennis shoes. No joke. Try doing that sometime. It's not easy. But it's what it looks like to want to be with someone that bad. I was free-falling in my socks and laughed when I realized what I'd done. After a long minute of free-falling, I reached behind me and pulled on the hacky sack. The parachute came out, and I landed in a field near Adam. He pretended he didn't know me as I walked in my socks over to the airplane after it landed to get my tennis shoes back. I know a little bit more now what it feels like to be a father who wants to be with his kids. Jesus did something a lot like what I did with Adam. He jumped out of heaven to be with us. I've been watching Adam his whole life. I know all about Adam, and he knows quite a bit about me. Still, there's a big difference between knowing what someone's doing and being with them while they do it. God knew we'd know the difference, too. This has been the easiest way for me to understand one reason why God sent Jesus to us. He wasn't sent because God was mad at us. He jumped out of heaven and came as Emmanuel because he wanted to be God with us. I've taken plenty of bar exams in the course of my career as a lawyer and have been licensed to practice law in quite a few states. Each of these bar exams takes between 2 and 3 days, depending on the state, and they test everything you know about the law. By the end, your mind feels like melted Velveeta, because you've gone through more than 30 long hours of testing. Guess how long the final test is while you're free-falling to get your skydiving license? Half a minute. No lie. All you have to do is simply obey what you're told to do for just 30 seconds. Some people I've met who like Jesus a lot have told me they're going to do whatever he tells them to do for the rest of their lives. I think that's terrific. While I'd like to say the same thing with even half the confidence they have, I just can't. It's easy to talk about big ambitions you have for your faith, and theirs is certainly a beautiful one. I've started a couple diets this way on January 1st, but I didn't make it as far as I thought I would. What I've been doing with my faith is this. Instead of saying I'm going to believe in Jesus my whole life, I've been trying to actually obey Jesus for 30 seconds at a time. Here's how it works. When I meet somebody who's hard to get along with, I think, can I love that person for the next 30 seconds? While they continue to irritate me, I find myself counting silently, 27, 28, 29, and before I get to 30, I say to myself, okay, I'm going to love that person for 30 more seconds. This is what I've been doing with the difficult commands of Jesus too. Instead of agreeing with all of them, I'm trying to obey God for 30 seconds at a time and live into them. I try to love the person in front of me the way Jesus did for the next 30 seconds, rather than merely agree with Jesus and avoid them entirely, which I'm sad to say comes easier to me. I try to see difficult people in front of me for who they could become someday, and I keep reminding myself about this possibility for 30 seconds at a time. It's easy to agree with what Jesus said. What's hard is actually doing what Jesus did. For me, agreeing is cheap and obeying is costly. Obeying is costly because it's uncomfortable. It makes me grow one decision and one discussion at a time. It makes me put away my pride. These are the kinds of decisions that aren't made once for a lifetime. They're made 30 seconds at a time. When you're getting your skydiving license, most of the class isn't spent talking about what happens when things go right and the parachute opens correctly. Instead, they prepare you for what to do when it doesn't. That seemed like a good idea to me. One of the things they teach you feels counterintuitive. The parachute is connected to your harness by hundreds of small strings. When it opens, you're supposed to look up and see if all the strings are where they're supposed to be. If there's just one string caught over the top of the parachute, they tell you to cut away the entire parachute, start free-falling again, then pull the emergency chute. I remember thinking, are you kidding me? There's no way I'm cutting away an almost perfect parachute because one small string out of hundreds of them is out of place. It's good enough, right? Here's the problem. If even one string is over the top, then the parachute will look like it's fine while you're up in the air, but you'll never be able to land it. You won't realize this until you get close to the ground and hit hard. The same is true with our lives. I've tried to fly my faith more than a couple times with a few strings over the top. Maybe you have too. It was colorful and looked good on the outside. To most people, it even appeared to be flying the way it's supposed to. I wasn't trying to fake it or be a fraud. Most of us aren't. While I knew I had a string or two over the top, the idea of cutting away everything and starting all over again sounded too excessive to me. It sounded reckless, unsafe. Perhaps it does to you too. It didn't to Jesus, though. He said he wanted us to become new creations. His plan for a renewal is that we cut away all the things hanging us up and start all over again each day with him. He talked about cutting away things that entangle us and about pruning more than parachutes, but the concept is the same. When we get the wrong things over the top of our lives, we might look good for a short time, but we won't land our lives well. If you have a string or two over the top of your life, cut it away. Will it be scary? You bet. Do it anyway. There's one last thing the instructor told us in class. He said if the main parachute doesn't open up and the reserve parachute doesn't either, you've got about 45 seconds before you hit the ground and make your mark. I was surprised and a little grossed out when the instructor said hitting the ground isn't what kills you. Every bone in your body will break, of course, but after you hit the ground, you'll bounce, and it's the second time you hit that kills you, as all the broken bones puncture all of your organs. I know it's kind of graphic, but it's true. I'm a lawyer, so with this information in mind, I figured I needed a strategy. Here's mine. If none of the parachutes open up, when I hit the ground, I'm going to grab the grass and avoid the bounce. What's true in skydiving is true in our lives. It's usually not the initial failure that takes any of us out. It's the bounce. We've all hit the ground hard at work or in a relationship or with a big ambition. Whether we had a big public failure or even a bigger private one, the initial failure won't crush our spirit or kill our faith. It's the second hit that does. The second hit is what follows when things go massively wrong or we fail big, and the people we thought would rush to us create distance instead. They express disapproval or treat us with polite indifference. If we want to be like Jesus, here's our simple and courageous job. Catch people on the bounce. When they mess up, reach out to them with love and acceptance the way Jesus did. When they hit hard, run to them with your arms wide open to hug them even harder. God wants us to be with them when they mess up, and he wants us to participate. I keep putting on my parachute and getting in the plane with Adam on the weekends. Truth be known, I don't like skydiving as much as he does, but I like Adam a lot. Find what the people you love want to do and go be with them in it. If Adam wanted to make pizzas, I'd grow the tomatoes. Be with each other. Don't just gather information about people who have failed big or are in need. Go be with them. When you get there, don't just be in proximity, be present. Catch them. Don't try to teach them. There's a big difference. We don't need a plan to do these things. We don't need to wait for just the right moment. We just need to show up, grab a parachute, and when it's time, jump out of our shoes after people the way Jesus jumped out of heaven to be with us. Sometimes we make loving people a lot more complicated than Jesus did. You don't need to. It's just up, down, and out. Chapter 7. A Day at the Museum. It doesn't matter what our faith looks like. It matters what it is. Have you ever been to Madame Tussauds? It's a wax museum. It's where all bees go to retire. There are several of these museums around the world, and I've been to all of them. Sometimes I ask the person selling tickets where I can find a candle wick and some matches just to see the response. But I'm not fascinated with the wax people. I love looking at the real people who go to wax museums to look at the wax people. Do it sometime. Honest, it's worth the price of admission. Everyone's there. Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Elvis. It's like a reunion of the dead. If I were in charge of the wax museum, I'd have an exhibit of a wax person with way too much body hair waxing themselves. Nobody would get it, of course, but I'd still think it was pretty funny. I was in Washington, D.C. a while back for some meetings. I had on a black suit, a trench coat, and my best clip-on tie. With my white hair and whiskers, I looked like a senator. I had the kids with me and could tell they were a little bored, so I asked them, "Hey, do you want to go to the wax museum?" They'd never gone, so they jumped at the chance. We got to Madame Tussauds and ran downstairs to where all the wax people were. When we got there, just for fun, I struck a pose between the third and fourth wax guys on display. I whispered to the kids, "Watch this." They all shook their heads saying, "Dad, would you please act your age?" I put my fingers to my lips and whispered, "I am." I could hear a couple of people coming, so I froze. Two little old ladies were heading my way. When they came around the corner, they walked up to me and got uncomfortably close to my face. One of the elderly women licked her fingers and touched my cheek. I thought I might hurl, but I didn't. The other reached out her hand and pulled on my whiskers with her pinched fingers. They looked at each other in amazement and back at me again and said, "He looks so real." Because I'm a lawyer, I knew I couldn't move. They would have strokes and someone would end up owning my house. So I froze and took it like a wax man. After a long minute or two, they moved on to the next wax guy and began pinching his face and pulling on his clothing. When they were a safe distance away, I caught the corner of their eyes as they looked back. I took a step forward, waved at them, and mouthed the words, "I'm not wax." One of the ladies dropped her handbag and froze. Meanwhile, Lindsay, Richard, and Adam were bolting for the exit to hail a cab for a fast getaway. Do you know what I realized about myself that day? I'm a really good poser. It's probably why I'm a pretty good lawyer. You see, I know how to fake it really well. You probably do too. Most of us have been posers at one time or another, if we're honest. People who are becoming love stop faking it about who they are and where they are in their lives and their faith. When I was in high school, there was a trick if someone who was 18 wanted to pass for someone who was 21. If their birth year ended in a 9, they could take their driver's license, razor blade out the 9, and flip it over and glue it back in as a 6. This inversion made it appear on the license that they were 3 years older than they were. It was a felony and could land you in jail, but they could instantly gain 3 years in age. Licenses are a little more sophisticated now than they were then. Still, a lot of people are cutting out parts of their life, flipping them over, and pretending to be someone they aren't yet. We all do it to greater or lesser degrees. It's not for malicious reasons. We all have this idea of who we want to be. So while we're getting there, it's easy to pretend we're older or smarter or even believe in God more than we actually do. The longer we've been doing it, the better we get at it, or so it seems. God, of course, sees right through it. And quite often the people around us do too. The sad fact is, we're usually the only ones getting fooled. We get so good at fooling other people and reading our own news clippings about who we are that we end up believing we've arrived at a place we haven't yet. It's why some of us buy expensive cars or boats or homes we can't afford. We've fooled ourselves into thinking we can afford it now, when we won't actually be able to afford it for a few years. It's why we take leadership positions or get on stages when we're still working out the basics in our own faith. It's like we flipped the 9 and made it a 6, but God sees right through the things that we forge in our lives. There was a guy and his wife in the Bible named Ananias and Sapphira who sold some property. They lived in a community where everyone's needs were being met, and they wanted to do their part, so they sold their land. When I first read this story, I was blown away at the generosity of these two. I haven't met anyone who sold a home or a plot of land and dropped off the money at the local church or community center. A lawnmower, a couple of used books, an outdated laptop, or an old mattress maybe, but all the money from selling their land? I've never heard of anything even close. There's a hill behind our house in San Diego. Sweet Maria tells me to hike it to get some exercise. I'm good for about 3 round trips up and down before I'm worn out. One week I wanted to impress her and prove what great shape I was in. I told her all week how I was going to hike the hill 5 times on Saturday. I told her on Monday and Tuesday, I'm going up that hill 5 times next weekend. I told her the same thing on Wednesday and Thursday, I'm going up that hill 5 times next weekend. I told her the same thing on Friday, I'm going up that hill 5 times. Saturday morning finally came. I laced up my shoes and headed for the hill. When I got back, Sweet Marie asked me how many times I had gone up the hill. I puffed out my chest and with 5 outstretched fingers said in my most manly voice, I went up that hill 5 times. Then I thought about it for a second. I'd only gone up the hill 3 times, just like always. I wasn't trying to fib or mislead anybody. What happened was simply this. I told myself I was going up that hill 5 times on Saturday, so many times I actually believed I'd done it. The same thing happens with our faith. We hope for good things to happen to people in need. We hope it and we hope it and we hope it some more. When we do, our brain can fool us into thinking we're actually helping. But hoping isn't helping. Hoping is just hoping. Don't be fooled. It's easy to do. Ananias and Sapphira love God a lot. They sold their land and gave all the money away. Well, almost all of it. I bet on Monday and Tuesday, Ananias told God and everyone around him he was going to sell his land and give it all away. He probably said the same thing on Wednesday and Thursday. I'm giving it all away. He probably told everybody on Friday the same thing again. I'm giving it all away. On Saturday morning, he came to his friends and they said, how much was there? Ananias proudly said, all of it. You might remember how the story went. He'd kept some of the money for himself and his wife. It was an entirely reasonable thing to do. I do it all the time. It didn't go well for them. Ananias was posing as someone he wasn't yet, and he and his wife both dropped dead. It sounds more than a little harsh. We throw a couple $1 bills wrapped in a 20 in the offering plate and feel great. We donate a little to a charity and get a wristband or throw a few bucks at a Kickstarter campaign and get an album or a hoodie. We feel terrific. Even if Ananias and Sapphira gave away only a quarter of the money they got from selling their land, I bet they would have bested my most generous year. So why did they drop dead? I don't think anyone knows for sure. My best guess, though, is God saw they were posing and wasn't happy about it. They were saying to everyone around them that they were at a place they hadn't arrived. They probably wanted to be the people who would give it all away. They weren't trying to fool everyone. They had probably said what they were hoping to do so often they actually thought they'd done it. The fact was, they just weren't there yet. Me neither. It's the problem posers like all of us have. Chilling words followed from a man named Peter, whom they'd given the money to. You've not lied just to human beings, but to God. We all do that a lot more than we'd like to admit. Every time we try to pass ourselves off in front of people like we're at a different place than we really are, we end up back at the wax museum. I don't think God's in the business of striking dead people who misrepresent where they are with him. If he were, who would be left standing? The story about Ananias lets us know, however, just how strongly God feels about us keeping it real and transparent and honest about where we actually are, rather than faking it and pretending we're someone we only hope to be someday. I think God can use us wherever we are. The Bible is full of stories of people who messed up. It seems like failure in the world was a requirement for success with God. People who are becoming love keep it real about who they are right now, while living in constant anticipation about who God's helping them become. When they make movies in Hollywood, the director will have an assistant with a black and white clapperboard stand in front of the actor and make a noise when the cameras start rolling. This gives a marker for the movie maker to sync the audio and the video later. We've all seen bad movies where the audio track isn't quite synced up with the video track. What you hear isn't aligned with what you see people saying. It's usually not a big difference, but it can become a big distraction. My son Rich is an amazingly talented and creative guy. He makes videos like a boss and was helping me with one of mine. We didn't have a clapperboard when we were filming, so Richard had me clap my hands to make the marker for syncing up the audio and video. These days, when I'm speaking to a group of people and find myself talking about the man I wish I was, rather than the person I am right now, I clap my hands to remind myself to sync up what I'm saying with what I'm doing. We should all have beautiful ambitions for our lives and who we might become, but we also need to sync it up so we're not fooled into believing we've already arrived at a place in our faith we've only been thinking about going to someday. Have you noticed when people are taking photographs of each other, the person taking the picture is usually smiling too? Check it out for yourself. I think God does the same thing when he sees us. He's not trying to bust us when we fail or when we act like posers. He doesn't hang photographs of our mess-ups on the refrigerator. God is not in the business of punishing us with reminders. He pursues us with love. He doesn't grimace at our failures. He delights in our attempts. Does God hate injustice and wrong and evil in the world? You bet. These things killed Jesus. But Jesus didn't stay that way. There's a lot of theology behind it, but simply put, for those of us who have decided to give our lives away to him, God doesn't see all our mess-ups and shortcomings at all. He sees Jesus. Here's the deal. When we act like we're someone we're not, it's because we're not happy with who we are. We usually think we need other people's permission or love or approval before we can live our lives and pursue our beautiful ambitions. It's both good and bad. It's good if it causes us to want to pursue Jesus's love and approval more. But it's bad if we miss out on who God uniquely made us to be so we can be who someone else thinks we should be. God has never looked in your mirror or mine and wished he saw someone else. Every time we fake it and aren't authentic, we make God's love for us look fake too. He doesn't have a wax figure of us somewhere that looks smarter or taller or shorter or skinnier or more ripped than us. He doesn't want us to just look different. He wants us to become love. It won't be because we talked about who we wished we were over and over again or because we gave ourselves enough positive affirmations in the mirror. Only love has the power to get us there. God isn't shaking his head in disapproval as we make our way towards him. He's got his arms outstretched, welcoming us home to him with love. I bet if we could hear what he's thinking, we'd hear him whispering, "You've got this. Just keep moving towards me." Do you want to do something amazing for God? Trade the appearance of being close to God for the power of actually being close to God. Quit talking a big game and go live a big faith. One of Jesus's friends said if we want to get it right, we need to live a life worthy of the calling we've received. The call is to love God and the people around us while we live into the most authentic version of ourselves. We weren't just an idea God hoped would work out someday. We were one of his most creative expressions of love ever. Lose the wax. Don't fake it. Sync it up. Go be you. Chapter 8, Varsity Team. We're not supposed to fit in. We're meant to change. I always wanted a letterman's jacket in high school. These jackets were made of wool with leather arms and had the name of our high school across the top. A huge embroidered ram was on the back. This was our mascot. I'm not sure why. I don't think it had to do with Abraham and Isaac and the sacrifice thing. If you were good enough at sports, you got a school letter to sew on the front of the jacket. I wasn't good at sports at all. Having a letterman's jacket without the letter to put on it was kind of lame, so that and $60 I didn't have kept me from getting one. All the football and baseball players had letterman's jackets. These guys sat together every lunch day at what was clearly the cool kids' table. There was no sign at the table reserving it for them or letting passersby know they only got to sit there if they were special. Everyone just kind of knew who belonged at the table and who didn't. I didn't ever try to sit there. I don't think they would have pulled my underwear over my head if I did, but I'm sure they would have been totally indifferent to me, which is just as bad in a different way. Sometimes life as an adult still feels a lot like the lunchroom in high school. We all group together and then everyone just kind of decides who's cool and who's not, who's in and who's out. In other words, who gets to wear the letterman jacket and who doesn't. We're all insecure. We're all just insecure about different things and act these insecurities out in different ways. Truth be known, the people at the cool kids table are probably more insecure than the rest of us combined. As much as we'd like to say this doesn't happen in our faith communities too, it does. We don't have letterman jackets, of course. We have a host of other metrics to communicate the same things. Followers, fans, church members, stages, events, boards, and celebrity status. None of these things is inherently bad, but what they can unleash in our faith communities can be damaging because they separate us from one another. Green rooms aren't bad, but we don't need them. I can't imagine Jesus eating a Snickers bar behind the stage away from everyone before or after he spoke to them. I bet he'd be behind the church in the parking lot washing cars, hoping to see people arrive early and fight over the worst parking spots. There's a place at Disneyland called Club 33. Walt Disney built it over the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. It was a place designed for Walt Disney and his closest friends to hang out together. All of Walt's favorite things are there. Elevators from the Mary Poppins movies, paintings, books, tables, and other memorabilia. It's easy to miss the entrance to this hideout. There's just a door with a simple 33 on it. Walt didn't want to draw attention to this place because it was just for a few special people, not everybody. You can't even visit. You're either invited or you're not. I've been in Club 33 a couple times, and it's a really interesting place. But there are some odd things about it, too. For instance, there's a chandelier over one of the tables where you can still see the secret microphones Walt Disney installed so he could eavesdrop on the conversations of people sitting at the table. He didn't do it for malicious reasons. He used the information he picked up from the conversations to prompt an animatronic vulture perched next to the table to engage the people in a conversation as if it had been listening to everything. The microphones are disconnected now, probably because somebody told Walt he would end up in jail if he kept violating eavesdropping laws. Other than being a really bad idea, it was a terrific idea. Club 33 seems out of place in a magic kingdom where everyone is supposed to be equally welcome. Private clubs like this weren't meant to separate people, but they do. It's fine to have a place like Club 33 if you want to make some people feel a little bit more invited than everyone else. But that's not the way Jesus did it. He welcomed everyone and gave them all special treatment. No one thought they were rock stars. Quite the opposite. They knew they were all just servants. I was the lawyer for a church who was going to bring a band to play a concert, so the pastor asked me if I'd take a look at the contract the band sent over. I flipped through the contract and laughed to myself as I read the ridiculous things they wanted. The contract detailed how many towels and bars of soap would be in the bathroom, how many baby tomatoes would be on the platter, and what kind of bottled water they wanted to have in the green room. I was half expecting to read they wanted the grapes peeled for them and a team of people fanning them with palm branches. I put a line through all the nonsense and wrote in that all they'd get were Pop-Tarts and hugs. I had heard about contracts like this. When I was growing up, I listened to a band named Van Halen. Their music rocks no matter how old or young you are. It just does. Their song Jump is still one of my favorites to blast in my headphones when I'm trying to get the courage to take a big step in my life. The only blemish on their reputation was a rumor I'd heard about how the band put some quirky requirements in their contract. I did a little research and found out that deep in paragraph 126 of their phone book-sized concert agreement, they also specified what they required to be in their green room. Van Halen's contract said the green room had to have a huge bowl of M&Ms. Why not, right? But get this. The contract also said there could be absolutely no brown M&Ms in the bowl. If there were any brown M&Ms anywhere in the green room, the contract provided the band could cancel the show, walk out, and still collect their entire fee as if they'd played the concert. Ridiculous, right? Maybe not. Van Halen was one of the early rock bands to take to the road with a huge stage set, including lights, pyrotechnics, and other complicated systems. If any of those systems wasn't installed right, or the electrical systems weren't laid out in exactly the manner called for in the contract, people could be hurt. We've all seen scenes from present-day concerts where rigging, light shows, or other equipment have fallen and injured people. Van Halen was the forerunner to all these big stage shows. It would be hard to know right away if all the details specified in the contract for the electrical layouts and other safety measures had been followed. So the band came up with a way to know immediately whether anyone had read the details in the contract closely. It was the M&M paragraph, placed in the middle of all the safety paragraphs. If the band members walked into the green room and saw brown M&Ms in the bowl, they knew they couldn't be sure the people at the venue had read the safety paragraphs. What looked at first like an absurd demand from an eccentric or entitled band was actually a clever requirement with a simple and meaningful purpose. These guys weren't jerks. They were geniuses trying to make sure their stage didn't collapse in a pyrotechnic blaze of glory. Jesus didn't give his friends a bunch of bogus rules or requirements to see if they loved him. He told his friends everyone would know if they loved him by seeing the way they loved the people around them. It wasn't who they identified with or agreed with or admired that would give clues about what was going on in their hearts, but rather who they served. It wasn't the church they went to, but the hurting people they sought out and loved that defined them. It was how they loved difficult people rather than just the ones who cheered them on. There's no Club 33 in our faith communities. Jesus didn't give us a club to join, just him. He told his followers not to call their friends or their rich neighbors when they threw a dinner party because those people could pay them back. Instead, he said they should invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, or the blind to come because they couldn't return the favor. People who are turning into love take a pass on all the special places at the cool table. Find the people who don't get invited anywhere and invite them to the kids' table. It's where you'll always find Jesus sitting. In kindergarten, my teacher would arrange our chairs four to a table. A friend of mine tells a beautiful story of a teacher who asked the kids in her class each week to let her know who they wanted to sit with the next week. She didn't do this to find out who were already buddies. She wanted to find out who was lonely, who wasn't on anyone's list. Jesus said we should do the same. Following Jesus means loving the cool kids, but finding the lonely ones. When I have the chance to speak at churches, we usually send a letter or make a call in advance. I'm a sucker for chocolate, but it's not brown M&Ms I want. We ask for a hose, a bucket, a sponge, and some soap. Between the services, if I'm not given hugs, we're washing cars with the pastors and staff. If the church doesn't have a bucket, we use the offering trays. There's no place for exclusivity in our faith communities. Following Jesus' example, the people in front should be spending a good amount of time in back. I found most of them already are. Go find them. Give them a hug, but also bring a sponge to use yourself. Jesus said most people would learn about who he was by watching how we loved each other in the parking lots, not what we said from the pulpit. Every time I see a bowl of M&Ms now, it's a reminder to fill my week with the people Jesus talked about. The overlooked and the lonely. The ones who feel out of place. The ones Jesus said have tremendous things to offer us because they have nothing to offer except themselves. Fill your life with these people and you'll figure out your faith. It's not Club 33, it's better. Chapter 9. The Pizza Place. What we've spent our time collecting might not be worth it. There's a pizza place near our house. I love this place. Kind of. They make noise there. Lots of it. I'm certain it's where all of the noise in the universe is manufactured. I suspect they have machines in the back rooms filled with vats of the stuff. I bet it gets dropped off in the middle of the night after junior high school basketball games where noise is collected by the barrel. NASA probably sends its astronauts to this place to prepare them for the deafening noise of rocket launches. My best guess is the noise they don't pipe into the pizza parlors, they sell to heavy metal bands for the guys to lip-sync to. The rest is released into the atmosphere. It's actually what is melting all of our ice caps. Each of the stores in the pizza chain runs on pure sugar, but they also serve pizza. Lots of pizza. Some people think it tastes like dog food, but I like it. One thing I don't get, their mascot is an animal we used to set traps for around the house. What marketing guy thinks up this stuff? To me, this looks like one big class action lawsuit waiting to happen. There are also games. Some of these games give the players tickets when they play them. I think it's why everybody puts up with all the noise and pizza they don't like. They figured out people do just about anything for a handful of tickets. One game was always a favorite for our kids. It's called Skee-Ball. It's like a miniature bowling alley got together with a skateboard ramp. There are holes at the far end that always appear to be just smaller than the balls you roll at them. If one of these balls goes through a hole, which happens infrequently, lights flash and a few red tickets roll out of the game. You can cash in these tickets for prizes at a booth near the door if you want. I'd been taking my kids to this pizza place for years, and we'd spend most of our time playing skee-ball. We got pretty good at it. Only a few of the balls I roll flew through nearby store windows. We saved up all of our tickets in a shoebox for a long time so we could trade them in someday and get something really terrific. Finally, after years of collecting tickets, I went to the prize counter with my box of tickets. I bet I had 1,000 of them. I thought I was going to get a Porsche. I shoved the red tickets across the counter like they were salmon, and I was the captain of a big Alaskan fishing boat. The guy behind the counter counted my tickets once and recounted them to make sure he got it right. When he was all done, you know what they gave me? A pencil. That was all I got in exchange for 1,000 tickets. And the pencil didn't even have an eraser. He said that would be 500 more tickets. I walked away mumbling, "Curse you, pizza dude." What I didn't know until I finally got to the prize counter was all these tickets I'd been saving up for years were utterly worthless. People who are becoming love stop collecting tickets. They don't do nice things for Jesus, thinking they'll get a bunch of tickets they can trade someday for an eraser full of grace. This is because they don't think grace is something we could trade good conduct for. They don't take the bait and collect what has no value to God. They shun all the attention because they don't need it anymore. They realize bright lights don't need spotlights. Instead, they see every act of selfless love as a declaration of their faith. They've come to see love as its own reward simply because it pleases God. These same people who are becoming love stop keeping track of other people's tickets too. Instead of evaluating what others are doing, they see them as people who are on their own adventure with God. They don't stop counting because they don't care. They're just so busy engaging what God is doing in the world, it doesn't matter anymore. There's an organization I started years ago. The website said something about how we were saving a whole generation of Ugandans. At one point, I had to ask myself why I felt I needed to overstate what we were doing. A whole generation? Really? I don't think so. We have 500 kids in a school out of a country of 44 million. People like me, who overstate the good we've done, usually do it because we're looking for validation. We're ticket counters. I was making a big deal out of my small acts of kindness. I didn't have a bad or malicious intent, just a confused one. People who are ticket counters are insecure about how much God loves us, so we mistakenly try to quantify